welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with the movers and shakers, those film and TV makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, sound mixers, sound editors, film editors, composers, choreographers, stuntmen, stunt coordinators, and so many more. We talk to all of them. And boy, the past couple weeks, I have been really busy talking with people off show. And those interviews are popping up on the website with some frequency right now. Just go to behindthelensonline.net and check out what we've got there, including some new reviews as well. But today, you're going to hear my exclusive interview with writer, director, costume designer, producer, and actor Colin Henning. Yes, he wears all of those hats for his feature directorial debut, the beautifully moody and metaphoric Appalachian Dog. Just an exquisite film. It's a quiet film, but speaks volumes. This is his feature directorial debut, and I am beyond impressed. Not only am I enchanted by this sultry post-World War II Southern Gothic delight, but by Colin himself, who is already one of my favorite filmmakers of the next generation. And for those of you that have been on this ride with me for 43 years now, and especially the last 11 on this show on Behind the Lens, you know my love for future filmmakers. And it's been a joy to see quite a few of young future filmmakers at junior high and high school age that have gone on with their art, with media, with film. And Colin is now part of the next generation. Although not a teen, he is a new filmmaker. And I expect to see a lot of great things. After seeing Appalachian Dog, I can't wait to see what he brings me next. One of the things he's working on, I know, is a period piece. And as you will see when you watch this film, I think you'll agree that he is more than adept at period pieces. One thing that stood out for me as we were chatting is he is articulate and thoughtful, not only in discussing the film, but with the film itself. Every frame shows the care, thought, and purpose that he put into the production, as well as his performance, because he is one of the four main actors in the film. I still am amazed at how he could compartmentalize all of the different hats he was wearing. As I said, written and directed by Colin Henning, Appalachian Dog stars, in addition to Colin, Georgia Morgan, Haley Hart Franklin, Brooke Elizabeth, and Aaron J. Stewart. It was shot on location in the Appalachian Mountains in North Carolina. And as you'll see on watching the film, in the dead of winter. It was cold. Appalachian Dog is a Southern Gothic tale about husband and wife Marion and Teddy, and Marion's friends Peggy, Kate, and Andrew. It's post-war 1946, and Teddy has just returned after 5 years to this cloistered, rural mountain home. After 5 years in the war, a tailor by trade, he's now suffering from PTSD and poor eyesight and is unable to return to work. He can't even hold a needle to sew a stitch on fabric. And he must rely on Marion to support them. With Teddy gone for 5 years, Marion, who is a skilled seamstress and worked with Teddy before the war, she has honed her skills and built up the tailoring business in his absence, bringing on her friend Peggy as her assistant and fellow seamstress. with Teddy's return, Marion has the fantasy or unmistaken belief that everything can return to exactly what it was before Teddy went to war. But life has moved on. The world has moved on. And although she doesn't want to admit it, Marion has moved on as an independent woman with new hopes, dreams, and interest. While Teddy must now look for another kind of work due to his trauma and his broken pair of eyeglasses. Struggling to navigate their tense reunion and build a future, be it together or apart, Teddy's return impacts not only Marion, but Peggy and their friend Kate, along with Kate's husband Andrew, who also returned from the war, a different man. What will it take for each to confront the truth that it's not only the world and life that has changed, but that they have as well? This is an incredible character study that just fascinates as you watch these once close friends, a very close husband and wife, and now everything is breaking apart. And one of Colin's gifts as a filmmaker is that based on his construct of the characters, the story, and the visuals, we see and feel what is happening with these people. You can sympathize, you can empathize, you can get very pissed off at some of the behavior, some of the actions, but you understand everybody and everything. It's really an amazingly deep look at the human condition in this very closed setting. You know, in our conversation, it's a very extended conversation, which is why, as last week, you're only getting one interview this week. Colin and I dig into this moody, metaphoric film and its character study exploration with the Appalachians themselves very much as one of the main characters. As you'll hear, the strength of Appalachian Dog lies in its location, Aidan Macaluso's exquisite cinematography captures nature so beautifully. Scenes of waterfalls, rushing creeks with snow melting in it, making the current surge even more. Nature serves as interstitials between scene changes. It's just so beautiful, as is the intimacy of the lensing as well. Also, Chad Hilton's magnificent sound design. So these three primary elements immerse us in the claustrophobic, isolated setting. And by the way, Chad also serves as the film's editor. And he and Colin are producing partners and have their own company, which Appalachian Dog is their feature debut for their company. Emphasizing the importance of character development, the region's traditions of the era, and Colin's insistence on authenticity. Something I don't get to talk about enough, vintage costume design, which Colin also handled, and as you'll hear him talk about, he is a quote-unquote clothes horse, is a big part of our discussion, as costumes inform not only each character, but the economic status of each character, cultural placement, time and place, while also speaking metaphorically to the unfolding tension among our core group of four. Going beyond the production elements of the film, Colin also talks about wearing so many hats and how he maintained the emotional separation between his roles, including as a main actor, while staying true to the story's meaning. As I said, this is the feature debut for Colin and Chad's company, and what a debut it is. So, take a listen as writer, director, costume designer, producer, and actor Colin Henning talks about his feature directorial debut, Appalachian Dog.
Hi, this is Colin.
Hi, Colin, it's Debbie. How are you?
Good, how are you?
I am very happy that I get to speak with you about Appalachian Dog.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, my goodness. This is, number one, it's a beautiful film. It's a very moody film. It's very metaphoric. And you really build on three of the strongest storytelling elements outside of your script. Your location, your cinematography, and your sound design. I am in love with your sound design.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
It is period perfect. It really immerses us in that mid-1940s. And of course,
I'm glad to hear that.
You know, shooting this in the Appalachians themselves really helps because you have the mountains. So we get this whole very cocooned, claustrophobic, no outside world influences.
Mm-hmm.
And that plays into each of these characters and what they think and what they do and how they approach things. They don't have the outside influences, but for Teddy, who went to war. So it's really fascinating. You really have a quartet of character studies unfolding here as well, and the dynamic amongst the four major players. I leave Andrew out of that mix because even though he does impact things, it's really the core four of Marion, Teddy, Peggy, and Kate that are driving the character studies. But were this set anywhere else, it would not be as profound as it is where you've set it and where you shot it. Just, you really thought this through, Colin. For a feature directorial debut, you've knocked it out of the park.
Thank you so much.
I have to say it up front. I am a glutton for cotton fabric. And I know you did the costume design. And to see all of those dresses, the cotton is wrinkled, nobody is ironing anything. Those weren't the days of Dacron polyester or anything else. It's cotton, 100% cotton or wool. You got wool socks, you got cotton. And you stuck with the traditions of that era. We had, you know, the wider collars. I mean, it's very era appropriate in the costume design, in the fabrications, and in the styles. I love the tiny little calico prints that you have, and it's also all very Southern. My mother grew up in Columbus, Georgia in the 30s and 40s, and my grandmother spent her life there until she passed. I have an aunt that still lives in Omaha, right outside of Columbus, and I've been there, so I know, like, the Chattahoochee River going up towards and the Appalachians in Chattahoochee National Park, further north in Atlanta, towards Atlanta. So watching your film, I mean, it's like lifting photos out of my photo albums of my relatives from the past.
I love to hear that. That's amazing.
So on so many levels, you spoke to me with this film, Colin. But I've got to know, where did this idea come from? This is not a traditional idea for a story, especially for your feature directorial debut. And you're one of the main leads.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's always a hard question with, you know, where did this come from? I'm very much like a theme-driven person, so really figuring out what I wanted to say and what I wanted the subjects that the film would tackle to be was a huge kind of like guiding light for me. And then I'm from North Carolina, you know, I grew up so close to the mountains, so did Georgia, who played Marion. So really, once those two pieces were kind of put together, the location and the theme, everything else really did just unfold the way it was supposed to. I mean, my background is as an actor, so a lot of my writing comes from dissecting characters. So I knew I wanted a character-heavy film. I knew I wanted it to be a really, like, isolated setting. And I knew I wanted to wanted it to be in the Appalachian Mountains because that is a region that's kind of left out of serious and nuanced portrayals. I mean, we're so used to seeing, like, the hillbilly, you know? And I wanted to take a lot of the traditions of Appalachia and not water them down, but give us full-fledged characters that could be both familiar and surprising.
Characters, they're not running around barefoot and pregnant. And as you said, the hillbilly idea of kissing cousins and all of that. You've got the women who are very, very concerned about their dresses and their appearance. They are very fashion forward, which is, when you look at Southern women of the era, they were very concerned.
Mm-hmm.
My great aunt was actually the first female entrepreneur. She owned a couture dress shop in Columbus, Georgia. So, yeah, and my mother, all of her clothes used to be made at my great aunt's shop. So I'm very cognizant of the care that Southern women, be they in the Appalachians or just outside, the care and the detail that they put into things, and using things like ribbon or the lace on the collar, the ruffle on the sleeve, because it sets them apart and it stands out from the background. And it's their way, it's their way of standing out without being, number one, ostentatious, or two, not having a ton of money.
Right.
You know, we're coming out of the war and the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this attention to detail that you incorporated, just, it makes my heart smile, Colin.
I'm so glad. It's so nice, you know, when those things are noticed and received, because obviously they're put in there to create, like, an overall picture, and you never know how many people are really going to, like, pick up on those things. So it's so wonderful to hear all the little details that resonated with you.
Yeah, and even your color palette that extends from the cinematography, the cabin. By the way, I love the wallpaper and the tiny little calico floral on the wallpaper.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice touch. But your color palette is pretty much the same with the background, with the mountains, with the fashion, with the fabrics. But you have something stand out, like bright white bleached cottons or ruffles. But even your calico prints, you know, it's a darker, a dark navy or a black background. Everything kind of, it goes together. We are cocooned in this world with these individuals. I think it works to your advantage because, number one, it really helps. It elevates your metaphor. You have metaphor on so many levels here, Colin. And I love it because it shows me how much thought you put into this.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, that's my brain very much works in allegories and symbolism. And so I'm happy to hear that, yeah.
You bring in some faith, especially through the character of Peggy. And, of course, that is a constant in the Appalachians and in the South in general. In that era, very important. So you do have a thread of that coming through as well. But, you know, once you get this script written and these characters, how much of the characters that we see on screen did you have on the page? Or how much did the actors, including yourself, bring to each character to make them come alive?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I knew everybody that I'd worked with, so a lot of it was written with them in mind. And we had a lot of, you know, discussions about really the central conflicts of each character. So that way, each of the actors and I as the director were on the same page about exactly the trajectory of each character, because obviously so much of the film is, you know, very like Chekhovian, very underneath the surface.
Yeah.
So we wanted to make sure we were all on the same page about that. And otherwise, I mean, you know, how that's brought to life is very much the beauty of working with all of them. You know, these characters for each of the actors are at varying levels similar to who they are. I would say on the whole, it's the beauty of being an actor that brought them it was just such a wonderful time working with them, and that was also the benefit of filming on location, is really getting able and being able to dig into the text and dig into the physicality of that and bring these people to life.
Well, and something that you do with the characters, they're all going through change of some sort. Some are resistant and think that after a 5-year absence, hey, everything's going to be just as it was before.
Mm-hmm.
Not going to happen. Then you have to look at each character as to how they have changed over the 5 years. And you can see that in their relationships and in the conversation and the dialogue that you've written. So we know that there has been change within each individual. And when Teddy appears, we really see it. We see the chilliness develop in certain scenes, which I love. I love the blocking and how Peggy is off, you know, silently humming, sitting on the rail of a porch. Kate's inside, Teddy's inside, Marion comes outside. So everybody is drifting. This core group is now, they're all drifting and questioning. You've got sexual innuendo simmering, bubbling below the surface of every single one of them as they're all trying to navigate life and figure out who they are and what they want. Number one, it is so tastefully and beautifully brought to life, and it makes you think and ruminate as you're watching these characters, especially Georgia. She does an incredible job after all of her frenetic tantrums. And Georgia was like, she's the one you want to hate. You love to hate her because she's behaving so badly at times. It's the way you break that out and you bring that to the surface and make us think as we're watching the characters wondering, are they going to realize that they themselves have changed? The world may have changed, but not in this cocoon in which they live. And you have really captured that, especially with Aiden's cinematography. Wow.
Yeah, he's an absolute pro. I mean, in the same way that, like, these characters were written, you know, with these actors in mind, the script was written with Aiden in mind as the cinematographer, because he really has an eye for that kind of, I would say, reflective moodiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That really helps drive the film forward, because there's something really almost nostalgic about it, but at the same time, his work feels so cutting edge. It's very gritty. It's very sharp.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not glossy, which is part of why I love working with him, because it really sets the stage for the actors to get into that underbelly of their characters,
mm-hmm.
and it really leans into the ugliness of everything.
Yeah.
And that's just such a wonderful gift in a cinematographer.
Underneath the beauty of what Aiden is capturing on camera, especially outside in nature with the waterfalls and the mountains and the woods, I mean, it's just, I could watch that stuff all day long and not complain. I could put it on a loop continually, especially when we have Teddy and Marion down at the rushing river.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like the metaphor you've got going on, the analogy between the rushing river and the blood now coursing through her veins because Teddy is back and they're quote unquote together.
Mm-hmm.
But it's true. There is ugliness beneath that. That's another metaphor you create with your costumes, with the ruffles, with the white, you know, the purity of white, the ruffles, the prettiness, the lace, the prettiness. It's hiding that underbelly of what's going on.
Absolutely.
Aiden's work, I am absolutely in love with. And this speaks volumes to Chad's editing and how you go to nature as essentially your transitions and your interstitials.
Yes, that's something that, you know, Chad also did the sound design for it, and that was something that he talks about as being, like, one of the biggest gifts and where he had the most control in the edit was those transitional elements, because so many of the scenes, once you get into the movie, are, you know, fairly short and usually, like, one shot for, you know, a minute long or however long the scene might be. And then it's a matter of, you know, sound design for what's underneath that scene, and then how is he going to take you into that next scene? Mm-hmm. And so really going back into those transitional elements, using the wind, using the water, using the crunching of the leaves, you know, as those things to keep you on your toes as the viewer and keep you really unsure of, is this going to be a romantic scene? Is this going to be a tense scene? It helps keep the pace of the movie moving along, and I think helps keep the viewer engaged and frames certain things almost like a mystery, which helps elevate the performances and helps elevate a lot of that subtext.
I have to tell you, mystery is the perfect word. This truly is a gothic mystery, a character study mystery, as to each one of these individuals in this very specific world. And how is it going to play out? But using nature, what I love is that it also, when we're in really tense scenes and somebody slams a door, and then we're outside and we see the waterfall or we see the trees and we hear the crunching of the leaves, we hear the wind. Then when somebody comes back in and we have the rushing of the wind outside, we hear it in the trees, the cold winter branches are banging each other. You come inside, door slams, and then immediately that sound, the natural elements immediately toned all the way down so you can, it's barely audible outside the closed, this cabin of this suffocating claustrophobia that they're in. I am in love with the sound design, absolutely in love with it, and the way it is married with that cinematography, with the cinematography and the editing. So between the editing and the sound, that is so synergistic, so symbiotic.
I'm so glad that was something that, like, from the beginning, we knew we wanted to use, you know, very little music in this film and really rely on the sound design. And I'm very happy with the way that all those pieces, you know, the edit, the sound design, the cinematography, all really work hand in hand.
They really do. And those prongs are really, that is the foundation of the film, that this story and the unfolding character study is built upon. If you don't have that sound, that editing, that cinematography in that location, you don't have anything near.
Yeah, absolutely.
What this is. Absolutely amazing, Colin. The work and the consideration that you and Chad and Aiden put into this, especially with those elements. Now, I'm curious, did Chad use a bulk of production sound for this, for those exteriors, or did he pepper that up from a sound library?
We used a sound library, and a lot of the stuff we recorded ourselves for Foley, because we wanted, like, the ultimate control over all of those little accent pieces. I mean, there's hardly a bird chirp in there in the background, so that isn't just, like, absolutely intentionally placed. So things like the footsteps or the crunching leaves, a lot of those we got ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So well done. And, of course, slamming a door. You got to slam the door and capture that. The way that door gets slammed several times.
Uh-huh.
Chad's capturing that. That's production sound that's probably enhanced, but that's a perfect door slam.
I know. I'm sure there's probably a doubling up or something there. Yeah.
Yeah. It is. It's precise. It's defining, and that's just it. The sound that you have, especially when inside, it's very defining for the moment as to what we see, what we hear. So that in many instances, you could hear a pin drop because of the tension. And, you know, we have a seamstress and a tailor and another seamstress. One would think that I would have seen pins falling all over the floor, but I didn't see that. So you, insurance probably wouldn't have covered pierced toes.
I know.
On a low budget, no budget, micro budget film. Talk to me about the visual grammar that you and Aiden came up with, because so much of this, it is, I don't know if you're using Steadicam, if you were on Dolly, inside, that is not a large space that you're working in.
No, yeah.
That was not a large space at all. Where you had the most freedom was out at the barn with Teddy and Kate moving hay bales, which we could even hear the sound of that. Chad made sure that we can hear that hay, as it, bales of hay as it hits another bale of hay. But you had more freedom there with your camera.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's really interesting because it's like we have more freedom on that farm, but at the same time, that farm is really where Kate feels the most suffocated. So then there's the fun challenge of how do we actually close down and isolate this world that's so much more open than the cabin. So that's where we're really peeking in through barn doors, or we're peeking past ropes. You know, we're trying to find different ways to isolate these people. Versus in the cabin, we do the same kinds of things, but a lot more in a way that feels voyeuristic. We're peeking down over things and through things. And that's the fun part about that cabin, and that also being the center for their business, is getting to just rearrange the furniture as often as we want in that main living space with the fireplace, because it is an area that's going to be in flux for them in their lives. You know, it's where do we want the desk for this scene? What's the best way to frame this for this scene? So that was a really wonderful gift for the cabin. Our big kind of MO for the cabin was intimacy and voyeurism, and for the farm was very much the contrast between that fresh air and emotional stuffiness.
The dichotomy is fantastic. Just like inside the cabin, very voyeuristic, especially when we get some shots, you know, through the window pane and the actual panes, the wood between the panes kind of blurs out a little and the window isn't clean, and very, very voyeuristic. And it goes hand in hand with the underlying sexual tension among everybody. Beautifully done there. Now, because of the limited space, were you doing handheld? Were you shooting on stick, Steadicam? What were you doing there?
Yeah, really the entire film was shot on sticks, which was something that was, again, really intentional to just plop you down and kind of force you to watch these people. And when you're seeing those camera movements, those are, you know, with the exception of when we're panning, when it feels like a dolly, that's actually something that we did in post-production, because we wanted to give this really, I guess, almost kind of like surreal or subjective atmosphere to what that scene would be. So we would create plates within the image, and then Chad, as the editor, would start moving those plates around, almost like they would in an old animated Disney film, where you have, like, you know, the far plate with the moon, so the moon never moves, but then you have, you know, the plate with the bushes that are going to be coming at you closer. So we're kind of having a dolly, but it's a dolly in quotes, because it's something that's created all in post-production.
Wow, really amazing. And something else that you also do, you really shy away from extreme close-ups.
Yeah, that was, I think I really enjoy seeing spatial relationships between characters and body language. I'm sure part of that is my background as an actor. And, you know, I think it's Betty Davis has a quote about how, you know, one of the best ways to show anger is through your back, or something like that. And you don't get that in an extreme close-up, which is so much of the joy of acting, and so much of the joy, I think, in a character piece is really getting to, like, see body language change. I think about how confident Marion is in the first few scenes of the film versus how unsure she is in the last few scenes, and that's something you can really only get in wides and in mediums. And additionally, there's also the element of, I think, I wanted to place you in the 1940s using certain 1940s methodology. So I wanted to really utilize blocking, because that's not something you see
today.
Used in the film nowadays as much as it was back in the 1940s.
I can see all the thought that you put into this film. It is there on the screen, Colin.
Thank you.
There is no question about it. Because of the fact that you are also in the film with a rather major part here, how well did actor Colin take direction from director Colin?
it was not my first time directing myself, so I mean, thank God for that. And a lot of it came down to me having to kind of read the script as the actor and not the director. And I remember, like, sitting down one day before we were shooting and just really pretending, like, okay, I'm not directing this. I didn't write this. I'm just the actor. And then I'm reading through it. And then it's like, huh, okay, yeah. And the way that I ended up connecting with this character was so different than I did as the writer or as the director, because in those roles you get to see where Teddy fits in this larger picture.
Mm-hmm.
And as the actor, you have to be unaware of everybody else's journeys, and it really is about how you are emotionally connecting with this character and also with the things in that character's world. And you have the responsibility to physically embody that and bring that to life. And I think the way that something can emotionally connect for you in your head versus in your body can be very different. So really embracing the things that made me physically inhabit that role was the key for me to really be able to kind of, like, I guess on set, compartmentalize between, like, okay, I'm in the scene now, I am the actor, so I'm not playing an idea of the scene, but I can really just, like, be there with, you know, my co-stars and really just give myself into that moment, because the best part about acting is spontaneity and mm-hmm. really not knowing what's going to happen next. And I mean, you do all of this homework to just show up on set and kind of throw it all away so you can just be there in the moment. So the journey to get to that was different than I thought it was going to be.
And you had more homework than anybody, because you had to do homework as a director and a writer, a producer and an actor. And yeah. It's all different homework.
I know. Thank God. Yes, Chad and Georgia helping me with the producing responsibilities, because I I would have been drowning otherwise. And I mean, I guess the best part about film is collaboration and being able to, you know, have this shot list and go through it with Aiden and figure out those things, and then have so much trust in Aiden. So if I'm acting in a scene, I would trust him to be able to call action, because that is maybe just one of the, like, weirdest things to have to do, is to be in a scene and say action yourself, because it's like, well, it's not really action if I'm saying it, because you kind of have to just wait till I'm finished saying it and then resettled in the scene. So the trust that I had in the people around me, is what made all of that possible.
Yeah, I know some actors who have turn director and they're directing themselves, and they themselves will call action as they're standing there at their mark in front of the camera. And it you know, the more seasoned actors who have become directors, like Greg Kinnear, when he directed himself for the first time in a feature, they know a little more. But you quite often get a lot of first-time directors or more amateurs that it doesn't compute. It's like, what do I do? And they don't want to hand it off to the cinematographer.
I know it's hard. You know, it feels like you're going to have to, like, let go of your baby. But the thing is, you do, because, you know, even when you have children, you have to let them go off to college.
At some point.
It's the way I like to think of it is, you know, it's not really my movie. You know, it's I wrote it and I'm the director of it, but, you know, writing is a very isolated thing, but directing is not an isolated thing. Directing is, half of that is just delegating for other people to be able to do what they know how to do.
It's not easy. So would director Colin hire actor Colin again?
I hope so. I think so. I think so.
But now, would actor Colin want to work for director Colin again?
the question that really matters.
Ah.
I would, on a set that had a little more time. That's what I say.
That's fair. So now, because this is your first feature, Colin, and because you are wearing so many hats here, you've got some shorts under your belt, but it's not just going from short form into long form. There's a lot more involved when you step into a narrative feature. What was the learning curve like for you as a filmmaker making this first feature? What did you learn in this process of a feature-length narrative?
Stamina is extremely important. And trust is extremely important, both in other people, but also in yourself. There's this very weird, delicate balance between having to be really honest with yourself, but at the same time, I guess we'll call it sort of, you have to be sort of like aspirational with yourself to believe that you can do it. So there's this need for willful ignorance and also this need for absolute honesty. And that tug of war to me is what made it possible. Because you have to believe that you can make the feature. Otherwise, you're going to wait. You're going to just keep waiting to make it and then never actually do it. But at the same time, you need to know what you're taking on when you take on a feature. And at the end of the day, I guess it really does all come down to just believing in the story that you want to tell. And my big saying for myself, whenever I approach work is, you know, don't fall in love with one way of doing it. Fall in love with what it means. Because that means on set, if you're thrown a curveball and suddenly you can't shoot that scene in the way that you wanted, or, you know, it's raining or whatever, you're not attached to the way that it exists in your head. You're attached to the meaning that that scene is supposed to convey. So you can immediately ask yourself, okay, this is what I want the audience to walk away with from this scene. What is the another way that I can capture that feeling? That way you're ready for whatever curveball is thrown your way. And then that applies in the edit as well. I mean, you might have had a favorite take on set of a scene, but when you're looking in the edit and you're piecing all these things together, you can't be so attached to that favorite take because it might not work in context. You just always have to be thinking about what is the feeling that I want the audience to walk away with. What is that thing? What does it mean? To me, it is all about the meaning.
Mm-hmm. Now, you just briefly mentioned something as to one of the considerations that will make you have to shift and pivot on a dime. And that's rain, weather. You're shooting in the mountains in the winter. Now, granted, it's North Carolina, and all right, over the decades, maybe there wouldn't be too much snow. Of course, with climate change, who knows now? You could have floods running through. You could have hurricanes, tornadoes, and a snow blizzard coming through. Did the weather impact your shooting at all?
No, thankfully. Ugh. Yeah. And that was something that we were keeping a close eye on, the weather, because we did have days that were going to be, you know, almost entirely inside versus outside. So we knew, you know, a farm day might have to be switched with a cabin day. So we purposely scheduled it so certain days could be switched with each other. Mm-hmm. And then that's the benefit of winter in the mountains is it's not going to be very wet. I do think it snowed almost immediately after we left, which I wouldn't have minded so much, except for having to drive back to the airport. you know, it was definitely something we all took into consideration and something that the schedule was very much a living animal of its own.
Now, did you have to build out any of these sets, or did you find this cabin, the farm, did you find them and were able to use them as is?
Yeah, very much a case of getting to use them as is. You know, bringing in set dressing, obviously, is something that we did. But, like, that cabin was just, like, a complete gift from God, honestly. It was really, really wonderful. We were going to go with a different place. And then through, and this was probably just like 2 weeks before filming, I think. We ended up going with the cabin that we shot at, and that really just felt like divine intervention because I could not imagine it any other way.
It's perfect. And what about for Peggy's house?
That was actually shot on a pickup day in New York.
Oh, my God.
I'm centered in New York City, and we drove up kind of, you know, upstate. And funny enough, that is still in the Appalachian Mountains because the Appalachians extend all the way up the East Coast. So we did film this in the Appalachians, and that was a cabin in New York, yeah.
All 2,100 miles of it. Goes all the way up. And it's so funny because I watched your film last night, so it would be fresh in my mind. Yesterday morning, 7 o'clock in the morning, I had just had the TV on, and on MeTV or whatever channel, and they have cartoons with Toonie the Fish. And it was actually cartoons in the mountains, and they were in the Chattahoochee National Forest talking about the Appalachian Trail. So I was like, okay, well, this is kind of predestined. I'm talking to Colin tomorrow. I'm going to watch the film later today. It's an Appalachian kind of couple days here.
Yes.
But now, hand in hand with that, with the production design and being so, with fortune smiling on you, the costuming. Did you make it, have it made, or did you manage to find the costumes already made?
I'm very much a clothes horse, so a lot of those things I owned myself. And the selfish benefit of making a period movie is that it just like enables my vintage collecting. So yeah, a lot of those costumes I already possessed, and most of them are actually vintage from that time period.
Wow.
Because I've been, you know, even in high school, I was, you know, making just, like, fun movies with my friends, and I learned so much from doing them, so I don't want to, like, discredit those films, but, you know, they were just me goofing around in high school, and the movie might have taken place in the 1950s, and then meanwhile you have, you know, cars from the 2010s in the background. But this is back when vintage clothes shopping was not as kind of in vogue as it is now,
yeah.
So I was able to pick up a lot of those dresses for very, very cheap, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And now some of those things that I got for maybe, you know, 10 to 30 bucks back in the day, I'm sure would go for closer to $70 to $100 now. So
oh.
I'm very grateful for my for my past self.
If you can even find
anything
from the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
The 30s, 40s, because obviously 1946 Appalachia, deep into the mountains, you're going to have stuff, even though they are seamstresses and a tailor and can make everything, you're still going to have carryover because of the financial status of stuff from the 30s.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's something with the character of Kate that we really wanted her dressed behind the times.
Yeah.
So when you're even seeing her on the farm, she's really wearing blouses that are really at home more in like the 1890s, early 1900s.
Yeah.
With a kind of overdress that feels maybe more mid-1930s. And then when she gets dressed up, even her being dressed up in that first dinner scene or that drink scene about halfway through the film, it still feels like it's about 10 years behind the time.
Oh, yeah.
Marianne, who is making her own clothes. And when she gets dressed up, it is, you know, right at the cutting edge of fashion.
Yeah. But what I love, too, is that you set up the economic demographic for us of each of these characters through the clothes. So we know that Kate, she may be on a farm, but it ain't doing that good.
Yeah.
And we know that Marion is charging a bunch for the work that she and Peggy have been doing, because Teddy's upset about what they're charging. But, you know, people will pay, just like now. If people want to pay 10 bucks for a dozen eggs, they're going to do it.
Yep.
So if they want a fancy party dress or a wedding dress, they're going to pay whatever you tell them. On every level, Colin, so wonderful. I am so thrilled for you with this film. And I can't wait for people to get to see it. And
thank you so much.
Let's see. I know, it's coming out. When is it coming out? The 21st?
Yes. Friday, March 21st.
Friday, March 21st. And then this lovely interview is going to air on my weekly show on Monday the 24th.
Perfect timing so they can finish this episode and go out and watch it on Prime Video or Tubi.
Yes. So it'll be on Prime Video, Tubi, anywhere else?
I think Verizon Fios and Hoopla are the other two places.
Job so well done, Colin. Are you working on anything else right now? Or just trying
right
to get
now,
this out?
I am working on a couple shorts and helping to put up a play that should go up in July in Westchester. And then I will tease that I'm in like a very early pre-production for my next feature, but I'm superstitious, so I shan't say too much about that.
Okay. Will you at least tell me if it's a period piece?
Yes, it is. That I will say.
Okay. Because seeing what you have done with this period, with the 1940s, post-war 1940s, I am excited to see more period piece work from you.
Thank you. That means so much. I love a period piece. I do. It's such a good way to engross an audience and, you know, get them to identify with a time and place that they might not otherwise have and be able to say things about now in a really universal and timeless way.
Mm-hmm. But it also, it lets you play. It really lets mm-hmm. you play in another era, especially if you do it thoughtfully and correctly, so you have the historical references, the visual references, correct.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's something that is wonderful about a time period is obviously we can't go back to, you know, well, I'll just pick the 1960s, but
right.
It's like, you know, when you're going to recreate the 60s for a film already, you know, is that going to be more the kind of post-50s Kennedy administration, very, you know, prim and proper 60s, or is that going to be more the swinging 60s, or is it going to be the 60s leaning into the 70s and
mm-hmm.
the rise of hippie culture? I mean, there's so much you get to choose
yep.
and play with, and you can create a bubble of a world in a time period that I think it's harder to do when you set a film present day.
Well, you have definitely created a world here with Appalachian Dog, and I can't wait to see the next world that you create, Colin.
Thank you so much.
This has been so lovely getting to speak with you, and I hope we get to speak again about your next film.
I'm sure we will.
Oh, Colin, thank you so much. This has been a pure joy.
Thank you. This has been so wonderful. I loved talking with you.
Oh, and hopefully we'll chat sooner rather than later.
Yes.
Thanks, Colin. You have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Colin Henning discussing in depth Appalachian Dog. Appalachian Dog is available right now. It released on Friday the 21st, so it is available right now on demand on Prime Video, Tubi, and several other platforms as well. Trust me, you will not be disappointed. This is a slow burn, but it's a beautiful, thoughtful slow burn. And I encourage you to take a look at it. So that is all the time we have today. Join me again next week for another week of Behind the Lens. I have no clue yet what's going to happen next week, who we're going to talk to, who we're going to hear from. So join me next Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time on YouTube, Podbean, the website. Everything will drop at 11 o'clock. Unless I'm in studio, and then everything will be live from Adrenaline Radio. But we'll see what happens when we get to next Monday. But for now, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.